So Buddha nature teachings, however we understand Buddha nature, are great medicine for various diseases of sentient beings, particularly the disease we call discouragement with practice. Sometimes we might feel like, I'm not getting anywhere, and all this talk about Buddhas is actually just discouraging because it seems so far away. I vow to become Buddha's way, but it just seems like little me, little old me, is so far from being Buddha, we might think. So Buddha nature teachings are great medicine for this, because the teaching is that whether we hear it as all beings without exception have Buddha nature, or all beings in their entirety are Buddha nature, there we have it. That's us. Whether we hear it about hear Buddha nature as a potential that we have, or our actual nature, whether we understand it or not, whether we appreciate our Buddha nature or not, still, all the different versions of Buddha nature teachings are this great positive affirmation and encouragement to continue this practice. I think that might even be why Buddha nature was originally taught, to bridge that gap between Buddha way over there in the future after countless eons of long, difficult practice, and little me right here now, to make that gap like no gap at all. Buddha nature's right here, always. And it's also good medicine for the disease of sentient beings called praising self at the expense of others. Praising oneself and belittling others. Because all sentient beings equally have or are Buddha nature. We might say, that person has more potential to be a Buddha than that person. But according to Buddha nature, no. Everyone has equal potential to fully express their Buddha nature, or we could say in Dogen's way of understanding that all beings are equally expressing their Buddha nature all the time. So it breaks down this these discriminations of better and worse and so on. So please keep in mind these wonderful qualities of Buddha nature, however we understand it. So Dogen's presenting his understanding, maybe a little different than the Indian sutras, but all versions of Buddha nature, I think, are very uplifting teaching. Now, before we get into the specifics of Dogen, let me just mention, because these will get played out throughout this essay, three or four somewhat dualistic ways of understanding Buddha nature. Traditionally, that Buddha nature could be understood, and Dogen's trying to address these dualistic problems. Dualistic means there's some separation into a duality of, various dualities can be brought up here. And Dogen's mission is often breaking down dualistic understanding to reveal Buddha nature. So a dualistic interpretation of Buddha nature is that beings have Buddha nature. So we've already kind of heard about this one. The sutra actually seems to say that. All sentient beings have Buddha nature. that's like, it's something that they possess or have, right? See how that's dualistic? It's something apart from them. They have it, and you know, maybe not that dualistic, because they have it as part of their nature. It's not outside of them, but there's a little separation between some part of them and them. And of course, we've already talked about how Dogen addresses that by changing the sutra, changing his interpretation of that character, u, which means have or are. That character can mean have Buddha nature or are Buddha nature. So Dogen turns the traditional understanding, all beings have Buddha nature, to all beings are Buddha nature. Another duality is that Buddha nature would be the result of a sentient being with this potential to become a Buddha after practicing. So that Buddha nature, that Buddha nature is like a seed or a potential to become a Buddha. It's often it was taught that way, and that maybe we'd actually say that Buddhahood is the result of this potential kind of developing into a Buddha. That's also kind of dualistic, right? Because it's the potential's different from the Buddha. But that's often how it was seen. Maybe today we'll get into the section where Dogen kind of tries to refute that kind of understanding. Similar to that is that Buddha, Buddha is revealed in the future as coming from this potential of Buddha nature that we have now, after some time span, that Buddhahood happens later. That's kind of dualistic also, right? Some future time. In other words, practice leads to the realization of Buddha later. And part of Dogen's teaching again and again through many of his writings is that practice and realization are not two. So if we say we have this potential Buddha, potential that's called Buddha nature, and then we have to practice and eventually realize at the end of long practice Buddhahood, that's different from saying practice, one moment of practice and one moment of realization cannot be separated. Another duality that we'll see how Dogen plays with here is that Buddha nature applies to sentient beings but not to insentient beings, or to all being. So these are kind of classic dualities in the way Buddha nature was taught in India, in the tradition, that, you know, maybe people thought Buddha nature was such a great teaching that it didn't worry about these dualistic interpretations, but Dogen's trying to cut through all of them very carefully. So now we're down to, in the text, the section about near the bottom of the first page in this version. A great many students of Buddhism, when they hear the word Buddha nature, mistake it for the self expounded by the Srenika heresy. So I read last week a quote from Dogen about the Srenika heresy. This is actually taught in the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, that this Buddha nature teaching is coming out of. This Indian practitioner called Srenika believed that there was some immutable, like, soul or spiritual intelligence in a person, that doesn't come and go, and when the person's body dies, the spiritual intelligence continues. And this is very much like an Atman or a self, which was taught by various other Indian traditions in Buddha's time. So I won't read that again, but I'll just, what I read last week, if those of you who weren't here want to look at it, it's in Shogogenzo Sokushin Zeibutsu, or This Very Mind is Buddha. About half of that essay, Dogen just kind of rails on this Srenika heresy. And I think there's maybe one other place that I know of where Dogen brings up the Srenika heresy is in Shobogenzo Bendowa. In question 10, in the question and answer section, somebody quotes this long quote similar to what we heard last week. Although once the body is born, it proceeds inevitably to death, the mind never perishes. Once you realize this not perishing mind that doesn't transmigrate through birth and death, that it exists in your own body, you make it your fundamental nature. Hence the body, being only a temporary form, dies here and is reborn there without end, yet the mind is immutable, unchanging. And this, knowing this, is to be free from birth and death, that there's this immutable, unchanging mind. So somebody is asking Dogen about this and saying, that's my understanding. And Dogen says, you've just expounded the view of the Srenika heresy. It's certainly not the Buddha Dharma. According to this heresy, there's in the body a spiritual intelligence that readily discriminates likes and dislikes, pros and cons, feels pain and irritation, etc. And when the body perishes, the spiritual intelligence separates from the body and is reborn in another place. That's the Srenika heresy. And then Dogen talks about the problem of separating body from mind. He's saying people believe that there's this mind keeps going, but the body perishes, and the mind is eternal. You must know that the Buddha Dharma preaches as a matter of course that body and mind are one and the same, that the essence and the form are not two, or that the nature and the characteristics are not two. This is understood both in India and China, and there's no doubt about it. Need I add that the Buddha's teaching of immutability teaches that all things are immutable without any differentiation between body and mind. The Buddha's teaching of mutability states that all things are mutable without any differentiation between nature and characteristics. In view of this, how can anyone state that the body perishes and the mind abides? That would be contrary to Dharma. So, and it's not so clear in some of these translations and some of the way of talking about it, but I understand there to be an important distinction between mind and mind nature, or the nature of mind. The nature of mind is empty. So that nature of mind is not something. It's the empty nature of mind. And that doesn't come and go. But mind is a conditioned phenomena that comes and goes and is dependent on the body. We could say that the nature of mind is not exactly dependent on the body, because it's not something that arises. The nature of mind, being the emptiness of mind, doesn't arise and cease. So, we can hear now how Dobin's going to talk about this. So, a great many students of Buddha Dharma, when they hear the word Buddha nature, mistake it for the self, this Atman, expounded by the Sreneka heresy. That's because they've not encountered a true person. They've not encountered their true self. They've not encountered an authentic teacher. They unwittingly mistake the wind and fire movements of their conscious mind for the enlightenment and awakening of the Buddha nature. So, wind and fire movements seems to refer to the physical elements of the universe. You know, we have earth, wind, fire, and water. And in our Indian Buddhist teaching, these four material elements are basically accounting for the arising and ceasing of the material world. And we could even say have some relation to mind. When it says here, the wind and fire movements of the conscious mind. Conscious mind here is in Japanese, shin i shiki, which is three characters. We also have it in the Fukan Zazengi, we chant, we say, give up all operations of the conscious mind. Same thing, shin i shiki. And it's kind of a Yogacara abbreviation. Shin is citta, or the storehouse consciousness is also called citta. E is manas, we'll call the seventh consciousness, like the thinking, discriminating mind. And shiki is vijnana, or the sixth consciousness. So technically speaking, for those of you who studied Yogacara, it's the eighth, seventh, and sixth consciousness is what's referred to in brief here as the conscious mind. And I think they often are listed together as three. They're just like the workings of the conscious mind means all of these consciousness, mental consciousnesses, even the most subtle storehouse consciousness from which they all emerge, all of that is just conditioned mind stuff. That's according to Indian Yogacara. And Dogen seems to understand that way too, that it's citta, manas, and mano-vijnana, the eighth, seventh, and sixth consciousness, and the other five, which are the sense consciousnesses. That's the entire realm of consciousness in Buddha Dharma. All of that is just conditioned, dependent, the arising mind stuff. It's not... it's not the realm of realization. Even to say, well, let's just settle completely into this storehouse consciousness and just be the storehouse consciousness with no sensory activity happening, that's still just deluded activity according to Indian teachings and according to Dogen. Pretty good, I think, you know, for Zazen, we could talk about Zazen as like what Dogen says, right, in his... As I mentioned, Fukan Zazengi, Dogen's Zazen instructions, and he says, give up the operations of the mind, the intellect, and the mental consciousness. Give up the operations of even the storehouse consciousness. Completely give up means let go completely of all workings of dualistic mind, even in its most subtle sense. Yeah.
Are you saying that, this may be evident, but I'm not quite clear, that conscious mind and conditioned mind are here interchangeable?
Yeah, terms? Yep. Conscious mind, we could say, that might be a nice translation for it, is conditioned mind, yeah. The wind and fire movement is kind of emphasizing that too. It's like, that's the material elements are creating these eight consciousnesses or interacting with eight consciousnesses, or manifesting from the eight consciousnesses. They dependently, the wind and fire movements that we can see in the world are arising and ceasing interdependently with these conditioned mind realms, right? So that whole picture.
Including. I actually wonder if the wind and fire were picked from the elements because the wind and fire are the quicker moving.
Ah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Whereas the water and earth are more solid.
Yeah. As a practitioner of Chinese medicine, you contemplate these elements, probably. And, yeah, I think also, like, yeah, mind move. I don't know exactly how they thought about this in old India, but probably mental movements and conscious activity is more associated with wind than with the solidity of earth. And fire is like life energy. So yeah, movement, wind and fire movement. Yes?
This may be completely off track, but the shrinikas, and Dogen's kind of disputing that. So I'm just wondering how reincarnation kind of fits in all of it. From what I can tell, reincarnation is not kind of a big issue in Zen, per se. Mm-hmm. Obviously it is in Buddhism.
Yeah, well, we don't.
Because if there's, theoretically, something is passed from.
Yeah. So it's a little, this could be a little tangential, but it's nice when it comes up, and it's because it's definitely related to the Shrenika heresy idea. So just briefly, I'll try to be brief. Buddhism. Before Buddha's time, there was the belief that there's this Atman, this self, and that's what transmigrates from life to life. So it's like this spiritual intelligence, this unchanging entity that just kind of like Shrenika's theory, really, that's reborn again and again and never changes. But the Buddha taught Anatman, that there is no Atman, there isn't this unchanging entity. But he did teach rebirth.
Yeah.
So that's like, we might think, well, how does that work?
Yeah.
Did he think about that? And it's quite, in some ways, it works beautifully with the Buddha's teaching of dependent co-arising. I think it was very conscious that he didn't reject the teaching of rebirth, because he rejected a lot of other teachings that were around in his time. I think to reject it would be, in a way, to reject dependent co-arising. But it's much more subtle than that gross view that it's very nice and easy to get a hold of. Yeah, there's this thing that goes from life to life. Dependent co-arising, like we said, these eight consciousnesses are not fixed entities, but they're arising and ceasing. They're conditioned, dependently arisen qualities. So mind, we could say, is... we could call it the sixth consciousness or the eighth consciousness, is like a stream. It looks like a stream, but actually what it is like a ceasing, like our mind just ceased. And then immediately, dependent on its cessation, another mind just arose. I mean, this is happening like every moment. So it appears as if it's a continuous mind, but it's actually, according to the teachings, and some meditators say that they can actually directly perceive this impermanent arising and ceasing of mind consciousness when very, very concentrated. So that's the teaching anyway, is that mind dependently arises, dependent on many conditions, and then it lasts for a moment and ceases. A new one arises very much like the previous one, because that's part of its conditions, is the previous one. So it's not going to be totally different in the next moment. That would defy dependent co-arising also. Very, very similar, but different. And that's why our mind is different every moment, right? Our mind changes, we say. But it's not something that's continuing through. It's an arising and ceasing. And that stream of arising and ceasing, we could say, is reborn. Now, the stream is not some fixed thing, right? We have to keep remembering that it's not a continuous flow. Maybe stream, to even say stream, is a little off. But it is a particular, we say stream because your stream of arising and ceasing mind is different than mine. They are interdependent, but they don't all just blur into one mushy mass of mind. They're distinct. So the classic metaphor for this rebirth in the Buddha's teaching that I think works quite well is like the candle flame. It's like there's the candle's like a body, and the flame is like a constantly changing. We could even picture a flame in the wind is constantly moving around, but it's kind of it's dependent on the candle. It's different than the candle, but it's completely dependent. You can't have the flame without the candle, right? So then you have the flame and the candle, but the candle's getting smaller and smaller after 80 or 100 years, and it needs, it's not going to sustain the flame any longer. So then there's this, there's another candle, basically. That's another body, and the candle lights that candle. This one burns out, now this one's going. So is that the flame is nice because is that flame different than the original flame? Yeah, it kind of is a different flame. It's very closely dependent on the first flame, but fire isn't like, it's not like there's one fire that's some essence of fire that's passed along. It completely depends on the candle. It's part of the nice thing. And then now it's depending on this candle. And that flame has some connection to the previous flame, but it's not the same. The metaphor is not perfect, but it's pretty good. And I just recently heard another metaphor that was, I think it was something like reading or, reading or like hearing some teaching, for example, is a little bit like that too. It's like, somebody understands this teaching and then they tell it to this person. Now this person has that teaching and understands it. And you can say, is it the same as the previous person? Not exactly, because it's like in their new body and mind now. So they, it's we could say slightly different. Or it's dependent now on their body and mind to understand that teaching. But it was, so it's not some essence that was passed between one person and another, but it's very much dependent on the understanding of this person. Does that make sense? I think that works as a metaphor too. So something's kind of like very intangible is being passed along in a very particular way. So that would be kind of like roughly the Buddha's understanding of rebirth. Or so even to say rebirth is maybe a little bit off, because it's not like there's rebirth implies there's something that's reborn. So the Buddha in Sanskrit, he never says re, he just says birth. There's birth at the cessation of one person's life results in the birth of another person. But he doesn't say there's some thing that's reborn. We could, in a way, say dependent arising is reborn, but dependent arising is just this flux of conditionality. It's not a thing.
Could you say at the heart of Shakyamuni Buddha's understanding of rebirth is just merely cause and effect?
Yeah, dependent co-arising.
Like nothing gets passed on with cause and effect. Like if you're standing in line at a store, somebody cuts in front of you, and you slap them, and then they slap you, and then you go back and forth. There's this whole chain of events that unfolds.
Mm-hmm.
New moments constantly popping up one after the other, influenced by the previous one, but nothing
carried over.
No thing carried over.
It's
just a series of cause and effects.
Yeah, that's another. Dependent co-arising is also called cause and effect. So also we have the teaching the Buddha taught that karma is connected here too, right? But karma is not something either. Karma is also just cause and effect. So this arising and ceasing consciousness is, there's various ways of talking about it, but that's like it's a particular karmic stream of cause and effect. So you know, there's different schools of Buddhism talk about it a little differently, how that works. But that's why the effects of actions create new actions and so on. And that's part of what's this process too. That's why the person born in the next life inherits, according to Buddhist teaching, these karmic effects from the last life. So the Buddha, the teacher. Yeah.
In other words, this course is the Buddha. How he was born as this person, bearing this name, having this profession, dying, being born as this person.
Yeah. Particularly
life specifics, profession.
Yeah. Got very detailed.
Yes.
And that's in the story of the night of his enlightenment too. So part of the Buddha's these three knowledges under the Bodhi tree were in many sutras the Buddha says, first I saw the workings of cause and effect and karma, and then I saw, you know, personally this all these, you know, way back, and other people seem to have these similar insights. And then lastly, the final watch of the night, I understood the Four Noble Truths. And that, we say, that's the main liberating insight. But he mentions the other two, and not because they're just random. We could sometimes refer to them called like random shamanic, not random, but shamanic states that were part of this, like part of Buddha's mind happening on that night, and that they're not that important to his enlightenment. But because he teaches them again and again, and that he goes on in his life to teach karma and cause and effect again and again, we could say that they play some importance in his teaching.
The author says that in the night of his enlightenment, he saw the rising and ceasing of the world system and universes.
Yeah. Yeah. He had a big vision of a rising and ceasing.
Definitely cannot be this personal soul memory.
Yeah.
It's a bigger picture.
Yeah, it's strange though, because how do we understand that? I mean, this is the Buddha's enlightenment. It's inconceivable. And what is it that remembers that, right? But you could say that's part of the amazing thing. Well, what is it that remembers 10 years ago right now for us, right? That's kind of equally amazing. It's just that the Buddha like opened that up like so vastly that he could remember that far. His mind was that clear. Yeah. But the main point here being that that's not this entity or essence called a spiritual intelligence. That's this unchanging metaphysical entity, which is very tempting to make it into one, isn't it? Which is why maybe almost every other spiritual tradition does make some form of something, some mysterious spiritual entity. And the Buddha almost does, and especially the teachings of Buddha nature come maybe the closest thing, which is why I mentioned last week, some people say, why Zen is not Buddhism, for example, because it teaches Buddha nature, and the people who make that claim say, you can't see Buddha nature outside of it being this some sort of mysterious spiritual intelligence. But that's why Dogen wrote such a long essay about Buddha nature, to try to unravel this tendency to make it into something without throwing out Buddha nature, because it's such an important teaching. Yeah? So, back to Dogen. So these people with this false understanding unwittingly mistake the wind and fire movements of their 8th, 7th, and 6th consciousness for the enlightenment and awakening of Buddha nature, or literally something like Maybe we could say like the knowing and comprehending of Buddha nature. The wind and fire movements of their conscious mind for the knowing and comprehending of Buddha nature. So we like to think that we can know and comprehend Buddha nature with our mind, with our sixth, seventh, or eighth consciousness, our conditioned mind. We can know this inconceivable, unconditioned Buddha nature with this conditioned mind. But who has ever said that the Buddha nature is possessed of enlightenment or awakening? Or who's ever said that the Buddha nature has knowing and comprehending? Although enlightened and awakened beings may be Buddhas, the Buddha nature itself is neither enlightenment nor awakening, or is neither knowing or comprehending. The Buddha nature is not knowing or comprehending. It's more literal. Much less is the awakening or comprehending used in referring to Buddhas as awakened beings, the awakening such people indicate with their various mistaken views. Much less is the awakening, in quotes, used in referring to Buddhas as awakened beings, the awakening such people indicate with their various mistaken views. In other words, we say, the Buddha is awakened, but we have this idea from our conscious, conditioned minds of what that awakening is. It means like, he like knew everything. Just like when we know, when we feel like we really know or understand something, that's like the Buddha knew like that, but just really completely. We can't, it's like, we can't kind of like step outside the box. It's very hard to not think of Buddha's enlightenment from our own kind of limited point of view, isn't it? We're kind of like, even if we make it like the greatest kind of conceptual view ever. And it's not the movement or stillness of wind and fire. The face of a Buddha, the face of an ancestor, that and nothing else is awakening. Or literally it says like one or two faces of a Buddha, one or two ancestor faces. That is awakening, comprehending. So this is Dogen's kind of poetic Zen way of saying it's not about this conscious knowing and perceiving and understanding. It's like face. It's just being a face. Dogen talks about menju, right? Face receiving, often translated as face-to-face transmission, but literally means like face receiving. Menju. So this is how Dharma is transmitted by like giving and receiving a face. It's just a face meets a face. It has nothing to do with understanding or comprehending. It's just a Buddha's and ancestor's face. Like, after all this talk about understanding and comprehension, it kind of cuts through all of that, right? It has often been the case that venerable worthies of the past, from the Han Dynasty through the Tang Dynasty and on up until the Song Dynasty, those who traveled to India, who've been teachers to gods and humans, as numerous as grain or grass, have believed the wind and fire movements of human consciousness to be the great awakening of the Buddha mind. It's a terrible pity that their study of the way was so lax and inadequate as to cause them to make such a mistake. So he likes to go on like this for a while. Advanced students and those with beginner's mind in the Buddha way, you must not make the same mistake now. Even if you may study awakening, awakening is not the wind and fire movements of the conscious mind. It's not this conditioned mind thing like that we think it is. So it comes to mind in Only a Buddha and a Buddha, Dogen says, enlightenment is not like your conception of it. And he goes on that way for a while. It'll, you know, anything that you conceive about it is not it. And even a person cannot even realize Buddha Dharma. Only a Buddha can realize Buddha Dharma. So it's like our human mind cannot realize it, but Buddha can realize it, and we are Buddha nature. So something can realize it. What's that other Zen saying? It's not that. You know, I don't understand it, but that doesn't hinder the one who does understand. Something like that. So, everywhere he says, wind and fire, movements of the conscious mind, in the actual Japanese, it just says movements for brief. So the translators here keep making that point. We're talking about the movements of the wind and fire, movements of the conscious mind, but literally he says, awakening is not movements. And even if you study movements, they are not what you conceive them to be. If you could understand the wind and fire movements of the conscious mind as they truly are, you would also be able to understand true awakening. So that's kind of interesting. After saying, you're not going to realize awakening with the wind and fire movements of your conscious mind, but if you understand the true nature of the wind and fire movements of your conscious mind, you can understand awakening.
That's like in the Gendra Koan, the end of Gendra Koan, isn't it? The wind, the nature of wind.
The nature of wind.
Is that the same?
Yeah. The nature of wind is different than wind. And the nature of wind is permanent. Yeah. And it's just like I was saying earlier, the nature of mind is different than the conscious mind itself. And like we say also, there's dharmas and there's dharmata, which is the nature of dharmas, or dharma nature. Dogen's got a fascicle called Hosho, Dharma Nature. So sometimes there's a whole essay written by Asanga, the Yogacara Indian teacher Asanga, called Distinguishing Dharmas and Dharmata. Dharmas are conditioned phenomena, and Dharmata is the nature of dharmas. And so we're distinguishing these conditioned phenomena and the nature of conditioned phenomena, which is emptiness. That's not conditioned. So there's, and then there's Buddha and Buddha nature, Dharma and Dharma nature, and so on. So here he says, if you could understand the wind and fire movements as they truly are, which I would propose is seeing their nature. Yeah, like the ta. You know, I don't know exactly what it says there. It might be, as they truly are, it might be like the suchness of the wind and fire movements, which is the same thing. Suchness is the true nature of the conscious mind. You would be able to understand true awakening. With Buddha and nature, if you penetrate or master one, you penetrate the other. Buddha is nature. Nature is Buddha. So it's kind of like the nature, we're playing with this word nature now too, right? The nature of a Buddha is the emptiness of a Buddha, but particularly when we're talking about a living Buddha now, it's not just kind of abstract, dry absence called emptiness. It's like aware emptiness or empty awareness when we're talking about a Buddha. Buddha nature is always entire being because entire being is the Buddha nature. Entire being is not an infinite number of miscellaneous fragments, or literally it says, is not 100 broken pieces, nor is it like a single undifferentiated steel rod or rail. So now we're getting into these two sides. It's not, Buddha nature is not like these thousands and myriads of arising and ceasing phenomena. It doesn't fall into that side, and it doesn't fall into this side. It's just one steel rail with no differentiation. Unchanging essence of iron rail. It's not either of those. In other words, it's not one or many. It's a raised fist, so it's neither large nor small. That's a Zen saying, you know, what is Buddha? It's just. Inasmuch as entire being is the Buddha nature, it cannot be compared to a Buddhist sage. It cannot be compared to the Buddha nature itself. Now, there's a certain group that thinks Buddha nature is like a seed from a grass or a tree, a plant. When the seed receives the nourishment of Dharma rain, it begins to sprout. Branches and leaves, flowers and fruit appear, and the fruit contains seeds within them. So, this is this one classic model of Buddha nature. It's like sometimes Tathagata Garba. Garba is sometimes interpreted as like an embryo. And it has many, many meanings in Sanskrit. So some people interpreted it as like an embryo or a womb that gives birth to the Tathagata, to the Buddha. So, and Tathagata Garba is another name for Buddha nature. So Buddha nature is like this embryo or womb, this potential, like a seed of a tree that eventually sprouts into a Buddha. Another way, as I mentioned earlier, is that another way to translate Garba is like the heart or the kind of pith of the Tathagata. And that's more in accord with Dogen's understanding. But this view would be like, we could also talk about, these are kind of three classic views of how Buddha nature works. One view is the production model. So that's what this is like here, where there's a seed that produces, a seed of Buddha nature that produces like the tree of a Buddha by watering it with Dharma rain, which is like teachings of Dharma, practice, and, you know, precepts, concentration, wisdom, the six paramitas, all that Dharma rain is watering the seed, and it's gradually producing a Buddha. That's the production model of Buddha nature, that Buddha nature produces a Buddha. And kind of problematic, huh? Because it's a dualistic model. That the seed is different from the Buddha. The seed's just not a Buddha, actually. The seed's just this little potential, little embryo of Buddha. So that is one interpretation in old India of how Buddha nature works. And a second model would be, we could call it like transformation model of Buddha nature, whereas like Buddha nature is like kind of impure, or sometimes we hear these like it's a pure Buddha nature mixed in with impurity. Maybe a little bit like the gold buried in the mud, like a chunk of gold buried in the mud. And so it's not so much that the gold is becoming like a big gold. The gold is already like, the gold's not going to grow, but it has to be like separated from the impure mud. Maybe we even see like they're really just completely mixed together and we have to separate them out through practice. So it's like the transformation is from an impure Buddha nature to the completely purified Buddha nature that's called a Buddha. And the impurities being our ancient twisted karma, you know, greed, hate, and delusion. And particularly delusion, they're like, I'm not a Buddha, okay? So that's a little better, it seems to me, than the production model, because it's not like you're becoming something, you're just transforming what already is into the full completion of it. But then a third way of looking at Buddha nature is what you call the disclosure model or revelation model. Production, transformation, revelation, or disclosure, which is like the Buddha nature is exactly the same as a Buddha. It's fully revealed. It doesn't become more pure because it's already completely pure. It doesn't grow into a full mature Buddhahood because it's already fully mature. It's fully present here and now. And it's just a matter of disclosing it or revealing it. We could even take it a step further. The Dogen maybe does and say, like, it's fully revealed, it's fully disclosed already. And we could say, I don't agree, or I don't see it. It might be disclosed, but I don't see it. And then, you know, Dogen might say, well, you're saying I don't see it. It's a perfect expression of Buddha nature. So not there's no duality at all. It's excruciatingly like unworkable because there's nothing to do there. But you could say if you say what's the practice then? Well, with a disclosure model, we could say the practice is disclosure. Or revealing, the revealing or disclosing the already completely present and mature Buddha nature that is, that's just presently radiating everywhere all the time.
So you're saying that's Dogen's model?
I would say that Dogen's model, I would say Dogen is a version of this disclosure or revelation model, And Dogen is rejecting the transformation of impurity into purity, and I bring it up here because I think right here he's rejecting the production model, which is a certain group that thinks the Buddha nature is like a seed, and then the seed begins to sprout, it grows into the tree of a Buddha.
The first production.
Could you follow those three? I think it's a nice way of like looking at different understandings of Buddha nature, and they're in some ways they're not that different, and they all kind of work, and they're all like in a way great teachings, but the first two are somewhat limited by their dualistic slant. I think it's more like when there's commentaries on Buddha nature teachings in old India and maybe even through China and Tibet and so on, some people taught it in that way and understood it in that way. Yeah, that this Buddha potential. I don't know names offhand, but it wasn't exactly like a certain school. Yeah.
is it a possibility that this was a skillful means to explain Buddha nature in a manner that was appropriate to the person listening?
Yeah, that could be. And to first open the teaching. So actually I do think of, there's what's called the Tathagatagarbha Sutra. That's, I think, people say that when these Mahayana sutras arose, that there's a whole collection of maybe five or six sutras that teach Buddha nature. So there's certain Buddha nature Tathagatagarbha sutras, of which the Lankavatara Sutra is one. But they say chronologically or historically that the Tathagatagarbha Sutra was the first one, probably, that appeared on this planet, teaching this Buddha nature. And in that sutra, it basically teaches all these metaphors for Buddha nature, and they're like the gold hidden in the mud is in that sutra. A Chakravartin, great wheel turning king in the womb of a peasant woman is another one. And it goes to all these, a shining Buddha statue wrapped up in dirty rags. So all these things where there's some pure essence that's hidden by something we think of as kind of grubby and poor. And the metaphors are mostly like that in that sutra. So, and that's a little bit like, we might see some of the metaphors there might be like the production model, some might be like the transformation model. I don't think any of them are exactly like this revelation disclosure model. And since that sutra came first, it came to mind when you said skillful means, because maybe first we're just going to, the Buddha thought, first we'll just present this radical new teaching of the Tathagatagarbha. And this is a way that, because it's a little more dualistic, it's a little more easy to understand. And then later, the teachings got more subtle. So maybe at some point I'll share, you can read in the Sharangama Sutra, which some people say was written in China. Dogen kind of criticizes Sharangama Sutra. But in there, it teaches Tathagatagarbha, and in that case, it says like the five skandhas that the sense fields and objects, all of this is Tathagatagarbha. So basically all, like the wind and fire movements of the conscious mind is Buddha nature in that sutra. So that's maybe, and it's probably the latest sutra, so it's the most kind of non-dual version of basically everything is Buddha nature. So Dogen's teaching sounds to me a lot like this Sharangama Sutra, though he never quotes it or anything. So I think, yeah, skillful means at different times, these different ways of looking at Buddha nature for different people. Even the very teaching of Buddha nature, sometimes, as I mentioned previously, Buddha says, sometimes I teach, or these early teachings, I taught no self, and that was just a skillful means to get people to not attach to themselves. But now I teach the teaching of true self, which is called Buddha nature, because now you're ready for this teaching. So that's the definitive teaching, the no self with skillful means. But then in other sutras he says, truly the teaching, the definitive teaching is no self, but I teach Buddha nature as a skillful means for people who are afraid of no self. So everything is just, everything that's taught in words is basically skillful means. And, depends which sutra you go to. So, this supposition about the seed becoming the tree is bred from illusion in the unenlightened mind. Even if you yourself should hold such notions, you still should penetrate in practice to the truth that seed and flower and fruit are each individually the unbared or the bare Buddha mind itself. Or other translations of this bare are like naked, pure, or sincere, straightforward Buddha mind itself. So I'll read this sentence again. even if you should hold these notions about like the seed becoming a stem, finally becoming a Buddha tree, even if you hold such notions, you still should penetrate in practice to the truth that seed and flower and fruit are each individually the naked, straightforward Buddha mind itself. See? That the seed is completely Buddha mind already. It's not like the potential. The branches, twigs, all of it is Buddha mind. Fruits contain seeds, and while the seeds cannot be seen, from them the seeds, roots, stem, and the rest of the plant emerge. Although they are not brought together from elsewhere, the twigs and branches develop and multiply, and the main trunk takes form. This is not a result of something inside the tree or something outside the tree. Since it always happens the same way throughout past and present, even were we to accept the views of the unenlightened, the roots, stem, branches, twigs, and leaves are each equally Buddha nature, living the same life and dying the same death as the same entire being. That's a great paragraph, I think. So, and it's, you know, it's getting into some subtleties here, like, how does a tree grow? He says here that it's, you know, the branches growing are not a result of something inside the tree or outside the tree. How would you say a tree grows if it's not due to something in the tree or outside the tree?
Nature of tree? Well, kind of playing with the nature of something that was on the page before.
Yeah, there is the nature of the tree, the empty nature of the tree.
Yes.
Any other takes on how the
tree process,
which is neither inside nor outside? Yeah. Yeah, sun and rain. Yeah, but not. But also, it takes some stuff inside. Right. Well, conventionally speaking, there's some like genetic structure in the tree, right? And then it takes the outside things.
How about tree disclosure?
Tree is disclosed. Yeah, each moment is disclosed as its new evolving thing. Well, what came to mind for me was like the teaching of dependent co-arising, that we actually don't say that, you know, dependent co-arising is not so much that the tree depends on the seed. It does depend on the seed, but it also depends on its genetic structure. It also depends on the rain, and it depends on no even list of a million things inside and a million things outside. It's inconceivable. There's so many conditions. Even inside and outside break down, and we just say the inconceivable dependent arising of a tree. Infinite conditions, that when we look for conditions, we can't even say inside or outside, even those are just conceptions. It's, the Buddha said dependent co-arising is inconceivable. and it's not a matter of certain things inside or certain things outside. It's everything together, without being able to name the parts. Naming, we can try to name some parts, but it's so limited, you know. That's how I hear, like, it doesn't come from just something inside or just something outside.
And then, of course, we can't say the seed becomes the tree.
Yeah.
Because the seed's in its own dharma position.
Yes. Yes, yeah.
Fire within the
ad. Yep, exactly. And Nagarjuna, the great teacher of dependent co-arising as the way to understand emptiness. One of his main reasonings, main metaphors for understanding dependent arising is the seed and the tree. Constantly in Madhyamaka teachings, you're constantly hearing about seeds and sprouts, seeds and trees, and it's basically like this teaching that, yeah, the seed, just like the Gendo Koan, is kind of a Madhyamaka text. Madhyamaka's middle way teachings of Nagarjuna, the seed doesn't become the sprout, and you know, you can't have both at the same time. But the sprout depends on the seed, but the seed has to disappear in order for the sprout to be there. And then there's this strange thing of where we try to get a hold of that and find the place where they link, like right where one disappears and the next one arises. You can't find where the seed and the sprout even meet in time. You can't find when you look, you know, we look superficially, we can watch this seed go into a sprout, but kind of analytically and very carefully, you can't find the connection actually between the seed and the sprout. And that's the startling thing, that kind of, if you do this kind of difficult work of examining that very closely, that's where your mind basically just kind of falls apart. And you can't, this is like empty, you realize emptiness because you can't get a hold of anything really when you examine it closely enough. So it's nice we have a seed and a tree here. And that instead of this tree potential that's in the seed, like there's some tree that like is abiding in the seed, and it's interesting bringing like modern genetics and stuff into these discussions, because still the logic is completely intact, but it makes it more subtle and interesting to say, well, the genetic structure of the tree is all there, but I try not to get too off track here, but it gets very interesting. But what Dogen's saying is Buddha nature is completely revealed in the seed, it's completely revealed in the sprout, in the branches, the leaves, and he doesn't say, but we could even say the dirt and the sun and the mind is perceiving it, and Buddha nature is completely manifest everywhere. It's not waiting in store. Buddha said, if you want to know the Buddha nature's meaning, you must contemplate temporal conditions. If the time arrives, the Buddha nature will manifest itself. Or Kaz Ta-Nehisi says, you must contemplate cause and effect over time. Or literally, it's you must contemplate or observe time, causes, and conditions. Contemplate time, causes, and conditions in Chinese. When the time arrives, Buddha nature will manifest. And this may come from the Nirvana Sutra again, but I think roughly. Partly it's interesting because we say that in the sutras the Buddha teaches Buddha nature is permanent. It's usually taught that way. It's permanence. It's it doesn't come and go. This nature of the way things, the way we truly are, the nature of mind is Buddha nature. And it doesn't come and go. It's permanent. It's outside of time. So here's like right back into this, you know, for those who study the Indian sutras, this might be like, huh? Contemplate time and time causes and conditions, temporal conditions. What's Buddha nature got to do with time and temporal conditions? Isn't it outside of time? So now Dogen's bringing it back home to particularity of, right actually now and here, a particular time and place. If you wish to know the Buddha nature's meaning, it is not merely a question of knowing. It means also, if you wish to practice it, if you wish to realize it, if you wish to expound it, if you wish to forget it. So he's saying, first of all, to even ask this question of, if you wish to know the Buddha's nature's meaning. So he's saying, maybe implying, this issue here is not just about knowing. It's about practicing, or it's actually about Yeah, practicing, realizing, expounding, and forgetting. This expounding, practice, realization, forgetting, and including such other matters as mistaking it or not mistaking it are temporal conditions. These are the temporal conditions
that we should contemplate.
So, I want to practice Buddha nature. A practice is a temporal condition, so let's contemplate it. I want to realize Buddha nature. Well, realization is in a particular time and place, so let's contemplate that. It's kind of like bring it back to the immediate, instead of this abstract, vague, kind of disembodied, ethereal, non-coming and going Buddha nature. Let's bring it back to actually practicing, not so much knowing in this ethereal, abstract way, but practicing, realizing it, expounding it, talking about it in particular words, in particular time, and forgetting it. Forgetting it. These are all temporal conditions. The way to contemplate temporal conditions is through temporal conditions themselves. It's contemplating temporal conditions of such things as a fly whisk or a staff. These are again, you know, the classic Zen particular implements, you know. You know, what's the teaching of the non-sentient? You hold up an object like a fly whisk or a staff or a watch. And it's a particular thingy in time and space. It's not like, well, let me tell you about the teaching of the insentient. It means like things that don't have a mind, but not as opposed to having a mind, but not as opposed to not having a mind, like that. It's more like, ding! It's contemplating temporal conditions of such things as a fly whisk or a staff. They can never be contemplated by illusory knowledge, non-illusory knowledge, or knowledge gained in original awakening, initial awakening, non-awakening, or right awakening.
This is the spot where talking always loses me.
You can just, you know, any kind of it's all about knowing, realizing, awakening, these kind of abstract ideas. He's saying it's actually not it's not contemplated in that way. Temporal conditions are not contemplated through any kind of knowing or understanding or realization.
The next paragraph kind of gets more clear.
Okay.
Either more clear or you run screaming in the room.
Must contemplate in the original sentence, has nothing to do with someone contemplating or with something contemplated. It has no correspondence to right contemplation or to false contemplation. It is just contemplating. Hence, it's not the self contemplating, and it's not another person contemplating. It's, look! Temporal conditions! For those who don't have the text, there's 3 exclamation points after each of these. It's the Buddha nature's emancipated suchness. It's, look, Buddha, Buddha. It's, look, nature, nature.
It's pretty clear. The others are much tamer, the other translations.
They don't have all the exclamation points. I think it's a... It's a Chinese character that's like a kind of emphatic, here now kind of.
It's sometimes spelled N-I or N-I-I for really look.
What does it say about that character?
Well, the word look in this section renders the word me, N-I, or me, N-I-I, an almost untranslatable particle. In normal Zen usage, is used to direct attention to the thing that precedes it
and to convey with great emphasis the need to grasp the thing directly.
We might say, check it out. Frequently, people of the past and present have read the words, if the time arrives, to mean await a future time when the Buddha nature might be manifested. Like the original sentence says, if the time arrives, the Buddha nature will manifest itself. So they think about a future time. If you continue your practice in such a way, they say, the time of Buddha nature's manifestation will come naturally. If that time does not come, whether you study the Dharma with the teacher or negotiate the way in concentrated practice, it will not be manifested if the time doesn't arrive. Holding such a view, they return fruitlessly into the world's red dust and gaze vainly up at the non-Buddhists who hold that all comes about spontaneously as a matter of natural course. In other words, they go, okay, let's just wait. It's going to happen. You know, we have this, sometimes we have this, I've heard this saying, I think it's Jane Hirschfield says, maybe she got it somewhere else, enlightenment is an accident, but there are certain practices that make us accident prone. And it's kind of nice in many ways, but it's a little bit off, I would say, according to Dogen in this case, that enlightenment's this kind of spontaneous accident that just comes in the future, some spontaneously or something like that.
Not an accident, it's not a non-accident.
Yeah. It's not an accident, and it's not a not accident. And it's it doesn't come about spontaneously, and it doesn't come about dependent on conditions of practice. That's really hard. The utterance, if the time arrives, means the time is already here and there can be no room to doubt it. Even if you doubt that the time has arrived...
Have you skipped a lot?
Oh, did I skip?
Frequently people...
If you wish to know the Buddha's nature...
If you wish to know the Buddha's nature's meaning... Might, for example, be read, right now you know the Buddha nature's meaning. You must contemplate temporal conditions means, right now you know temporal conditions. If you wish to know the Buddha nature, you must realize that it's nothing other than temporal conditions themselves. So that's a good place to stop. If you wish to know the Buddha nature's meaning, could be read, Dogen says, as right now you know the Buddha nature's meaning. And this instruction that you must contemplate temporal conditions means right now you know temporal conditions. In other words, don't look somewhere else for temporal conditions. Or don't think that like now you're going to start the practice. Or even worse, tomorrow you'll start the practice of contemplating temporal conditions. Okay, when I get into Zazen, what am I going to do? Oh yeah, contemplate temporal conditions. I forget. Oh, I forgot that period. Next period, I'll do it. Temporal conditions is like everything that's happening. You know, it's not what's not happening. That's not temporal conditions, but it's everything that's actually appears to be happening. And that's what we can contemplate in order to know the meaning of Buddha nature. It's right through, right in, right as each expression. May our intention fully extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. save them. The illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become. So when we say Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it. We can consider whether we think that that's something that will happen in the future, or the temporal conditions of those words, like dripping off our tongue, is actually expressing Buddha nature.